the Carter Subaru Studio. You are listening to the Jason Rand Show. If you want to join the conversation tonight, you know what to do. Send me a text at 98973. And of course, you can like us on the Facebook page at facebook.com/Jason Rand Show. As I told you last week, the project to build a new billing system for Seattle City Light and Seattle Public Utilities is at least $34 million over budget, and it's likely to be about a year late. The project was originally given a $66 million budget and an October 2015 deadline, but they have totally passed both. And more troublesome, the public utility spokesperson won't tell us if there's a maximum budget that they might need to get this thing done. Joining me on the line is a Seattle City Councilwoman who is not too happy with this. Seattle City Councilwoman Shama Salman, she joins me now. Councilwoman, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
So before we get into the whys, can you tell us exactly what we know as of right now as to how over budget they are?
The project was supposed to finish last year at a certain cost. And then what happened in the last year's budget, you know, that got passed in November, is that there was a clause for an increase of $20 million, you know, that is distributed between three lights. Half and public utilities half, but that wasn't made clear to the council. There are many different parts of the budget where the mayor's office could have and should have, if they were doing their due diligence, indicated that this project is running $20 million over budget. They should have shouted it off the rooftops. You know, that is what transparency and accountability all means. But they didn't do that. And then now the project has gone another $20 million mm-hmm. over budget, which they would need the council to approve this year. So in other words, as of now, the project has gone or is going to be $40 million over budget. And my question, of course, logically is, well, why should I believe that this is the last we've had of the over budget dollars? I mean, maybe they're going to come again and say it's going to cost more.
Well, the problem for me is, in similar sort of circumstances, is I see in the Seattle Times, the spokesperson for Seattle City Utilities won't give sort of a maximum budget that they might need to get this thing completely done, because at the end of the day, it looks like not only is it going to be overdue, but it might hit $100 million, which seems absurd just to update a billing issue. But for you, personally as a representative, what is your max?
I don't think we can have a generalized max. You know, it really does depend on the project, and we do have a complex project. I mean, I agree with Public Utilities and City Light that it is a complex project, and it does require a lot of, you know, error checking and so on before it goes live. I mean, I used to be a software engineer. I know what that means, how complex these projects are. My problem is twofold. One is that when such massive cost overruns happen, I think it is important as public officials, you know, for the mayor's office to come and explain to us exactly why this project is going over budget. Tell us exactly why it's happening. I mean, at this moment, I have no information as to why it's costing $40 million more. Maybe it is legitimate cost, but I can't say that, you know, because I don't know that for a fact. And secondly, and more fundamentally, I think the problem that's happened here is that the mayor's office never really flagged it for us in the budget last year, because had they done that, I can assure you council members would have asked the question, why has this project gone $20 million over budget? Can we have a briefing from the people who are doing this project to let us know why this has happened? Because it's a private contractor that is doing this, PricewaterhouseCoopers. They are not directly accountable to the public in any way, but the mayor is accountable. City council members are accountable. So I think that the basic problem here, firstly, is that the fact that the project went $20 million over budget last year was not reported in any way. I mean, I just wanted to share with the public what this means.
Yeah.
I mean, the budget, the general budget and the capital improvement budget, these are thick binders. They're like, you know, 1,000-page. Imagine reading a 1,000-page book in a week. This is huge. And I think that unless they had, without flagging it, without really showing what it's really about, you would need an audit to find out that this information was somewhere hidden in the budget. You know, if it was me, I would have said, look, I really, really want to make it clear we are over budget and I want to explain why. That that process never happened. And here is my concern, is that it's not just an isolated instance. If you look at the police budget, it accounts for $300 million of taxpayer money. And I've been raising this for 2 years that I've been in office, that we really have no transparency on that budget either. It's very opaque. They don't tell us how much each one, you know, what each line of budget is doing. And in fact, the police department has a trend of overspending. I don't know if you remember, but they were even caught doing overtime of greater than 24 hours per day. No explanation why. And the other example I would give is there is a special operations budget for the police that just says, you know, we're going to spend $53 million. They don't tell us why. So I'm just saying that there's a trend here of a lack of transparency. And I think that members of the public should you know, think about this. And I think that really what is warranted is an audit of the entire budget. And also, by the way, I'm asking the mayor to come to my Energy and Environment Committee on this particular issue so that he can explain directly to the public.
Well, you know, he's not going to do that, right? He's not going to show up to the meeting. And, you know, we've had conversations and we've seen news stories in the past that the relationship between you and the mayor a little bit strained. Do you expect that he will actually show up?
Well, for me, you know, honestly, Jason, this is not a question of, you know, interpersonal relationships. It really, this is political work. You know, I am here to do political work, and that work is making sure that the city officials, you know, City Hall is held accountable to the needs of ordinary people. And I think that when something glaring like this happens, I think that the elected official who is in the center of this should come and explain. It's up to them, you know, up to the mayor if he wants to come or not. That's his choice. But I think I'm doing my due diligence as a public official you know, making sure that I take every step now that I know this has happened to make sure that we address it. And also, you know, I think it's important to remember that the legislative branch is a watchdog for the people in the city and making sure that things are done well.
Yeah, and it's supposed to do that. And the problem is, and to your point, you bring up the SPD budget. You know, projects like this always seem to go over budget. And you and I both understand that when we're talking about any project even close to this level of scope, you're going to have some problems, right? Where
some of it would be legitimate, but the problem is we don't know whether it is or not. We can't just assume that.
But even if it is, doesn't that make the point of something's wrong? We look at what's been going on with the Seattle Seawall project. That thing's like $75 million over budget. They say that it was due to construction costs that were higher than normal. Doesn't this go to a bigger, an even bigger issue? It's not just about the accountability, but it's about the planning to begin with.
I think that it's absolutely correct for you as a media person to question and ask that question, and this is why I want transparency, so that we as members of the public can be in a position to determine what is a good use of taxpayer money and what isn't. I mean, this is a mayor who was a cheerleader for the tunnel project, which is going very quickly nowhere, you know. So I don't have any reason to think that any given project, I mean, I'm not going to assume that any given project is legitimately experiencing increases in cost, because I want to know why those increases are happening. And I really wanted to, you know, talking about journalism, I wanted to applaud Lindsay Sheldon of Cairo TV, who really is responsible for bringing this to the surface, because it was her public disclosure request that triggered the press release from the mayor's office last week, which is why we are talking about this in the first place.
From your perspective, from the Seattle City Council perspective, is there actually any way to audit these individual projects, or at least projects that are this big? What is the oversight mechanism?
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out now. I mean,
so it doesn't exist.
I don't know that we should have a standing committee for that, because that would imply that a lot of resources, taxpayer money, would be used to audit everything. That is why I think that if we establish a protocol for transparency where the public gets to hold elected officials accountable, then that will happen. And for that, what I'm recommending is not setting up a standing committee, but doing some audits now. Like, you know, and in fact, last year and the year before, I have been called, and as far as I know, I'm the first council member ever to call for an audit of the Seattle Police Department. That's an example. And I think you know, at this point, I think that the overall budget should be audited as well, so that we can figure out if there are other things that are sort of buried in the accounting, where the accounting is accurate, but just that important things or disturbing things or concerning things are not flagged. And I feel that some of these examples that have come to the surface, like this issue with City Light and Public Utilities and also the police department, I think these are enough numbers of examples that I think they warrant a closer inspection.
Yeah, and I think it's funny because I can make the argument you're sounding like a conservative right now, and you could make the argument that I'm sounding like a socialist, because you and I are making the exact same point, which is we need to be in place. We have to have something in place that makes it so that we can actually hold people accountable for these dollars. Even if we don't like where it's going, at least find out if it was necessary. And so you're not going to get any complaints from me on that one.
Right. I just wanted to clarify that, you know, the reason that, you know, as a socialist, I'm actually demanding this kind of transparency is precisely because I think that where giving money to private contractors and big business and, the corporations that have lobbying power, where those things are concerned, corporate politicians are only too willing to, you know, roll out the red carpet without questions. And when it comes to addressing affordable housing, you know, lack of affordable housing, homelessness, and all the critical problems that ordinary people face, they suddenly start talking about fiscal responsibility. And I think that, you know, the reason we're in agreement is because we do want to have ordinary people, regardless of their ideology, want government to be held accountable to ordinary people. They are not accountable to us. They are accountable to big business. Just let me just give you an example about these, you know, this project going over budget. Today, I questioned, this morning's briefing, I questioned those who were there at the table, including Mr. Larry Weiss, who is the recently appointed CEO of City Light. You know, I voted against his confirmation. I asked Mr. Weiss, is it true that corporations like Nucor Steel knew about, which is one of the larger, you know, big business customers of City Light, is it true that Nucor Steel knew well in advance about this before, you know, ordinary people, ratepayers, knowing about it? And he said twice, or maybe more times, yes, big corporations are told way in advance compared to ordinary people. You know, and just think about it. Nucor Steel is a ratepayer, but you and I and all your listeners are also ratepayers. But we are just ordinary working people, and they don't feel like they should inform us, but they feel like they should inform big business first.
But that's institutional, right? And so for you, and we're going to stray slightly off of the topic, at least, because I think this is interesting. You know, you have been fighting to change sort of the institutionalized policies that have been placed that have been keeping, you know, the average person from really having power. You're doing that in a place with other politicians who you believe are sort of either in the pockets of big business or maybe leaning in that direction. So how exactly do you get anything changed when you're working within that system with the people who you don't necessarily trust to follow your lead?
I am able to accomplish a lot, and as you've seen, the political landscape of the city has completely transformed because since we won the election in first time in 2013, because I go to the people themselves, I go to the grassroots itself to find my support, to find my, to find the strength that will put pressure on these corporate politicians. You're right. We don't fundamentally agree. I don't agree with the corporate politicians, and they don't agree with me, because I'm fighting for ordinary people. They are representing big business, whether they admit it or not. So the way we won $15 when not a single council member was in, I mean, other than, you know, council members Michael Bryan and Nick Licata, who spoke at the workers' rally, every other council member was either silent or not willing to vote yes, and ultimately we got a unanimous vote. We were also able to get, government-regulated safe places, you know, safe encampments for homeless people. We were able to do a year-round shelter for women who, you know, especially women who experience domestic violence. We were able to fund basic facilities for homeless encampments, including trash removal, so that they can actually have safe sites. All of this we were able to do because we, meaning myself and the movement, we were able to do because we fight to change the balance of power, and that's the approach we need in order to address all of these, as you said, institutional problems in a government that is mainly controlled by corporate interests.
But those accomplishments, and you should be given significant credit, and I've been giving you credit for the $15 minimum wage movement, despite the mayor's office's probably disapproval. But you also did those with those exact politicians that you frame as being on the side of big business. And even in this conversation tonight, you know, you frame it as in you're on the side of the people and everyone else is not necessarily. Isn't it possible that everyone's on the side of the people and there's just simply a disagreement on how to get to that end goal? Because you and I, ideologically, we are in complete polar opposites. You wouldn't say that I'm in the pocket of big business. If I were, I would be a much richer man. So you know, isn't it possible that we just see things differently, but we want the same end goal?
I mean, I'm sure that's true to some degree. And also, please note that I wouldn't paint every elected official
with the same
brush. You know, obviously, like I said, council members Licata and O'Brien were in support of working people getting $15, you know, from the very beginning. And we've spoken at many rallies and marches together. Councilmember O'Brien and I, for example, also recently voted no against confirming Larry Weiss, the new general manager of City Light. And we've worked together on many different issues. And I have worked with all the council members, various council members, on various aspects. If you look at the progress that we've made on the budget and many other ordinances, including the unionizing rights for Uber drivers. I mean, we worked on that. But my point is that I'm absolutely eager to work with any elected official who wants to advance the interests of ordinary working people who don't have a voice in City Hall. But I will also be boldly speaking out in the interest of working people even if I don't have that agreement. You see what I mean? I mean, mm-hmm. it depends on what positions each politician takes on a given issue. And if they are willing to represent the interests of working people, then I absolutely applaud them. And I'm always eager to work with them. But I'm not going to sacrifice, you know, what I want to do, which is, you know, represent ordinary people in the interest of having some sort of false, agreement. I think that it's healthy in a democracy for people to be able to elect representatives who truly represent them and who have the courage to speak out against big business.
There you go. That is Seattle City Councilwoman Shama Sawant. As always, Councilwoman, I do appreciate when you stop by and you're willing to chat with me.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. We are back at the bottom of the hour. You are listening to The Jason Rand Show on this Monday night. I appreciate it. Want to join the conversation? I would love to get your text. 98973 is the number. And of course, you can like us on the Facebook page, facebook.com/Jason Rand Show. You're going to want to like us very soon because we're about to publish a blooper reel starring our fill-in producer tonight in Jacob Rummel, who embarrasses himself.
And quite a reel. There's one.
It's a series of embarrassing moments on one video,
yeah.
Which, by the way, started off upside down, and I had to edit that in post. So you're going to want to check that out on the Facebook page, facebook.com/Jason Rants Show. The city of Seattle could become the first city in the United States that will house a site for heroin and coke addicts to show up, get high, judgment-free. You're not going to have to get any treatment. You can just show up, say, you know what? Why don't you give me a needle? Why don't you give me a spoon? I'm going to sit in this nice little corner here, and I'm going to get high. And the reason they're doing that is because Seattle. That's all I can think of. Like, I don't know why the city of Seattle would do this outside of the reason that they're constantly trying to talk about how progressive they are. And so they want to out-progress every other city in the entire world. And so if they can be the first one in the country to do this, they're all about that. They can check that mark on their little box, on their little sheet. Now, there are some pros to this. There are some advantages to this. There are. The idea is that this could reduce overdose deaths. Because if you're going into one of these places where you are being supervised by medical professionals as you're shooting up, you are less likely to suffer from an overdose. Good. We don't want people dying. You're less likely to spread HIV or Hep C because you've got a lot of people who are sharing needles sometimes or using used needles. They are so desperate for their fix. And so, again, they're able to show up to one of these places. It's called Insight is the service that offers this. Show up, you're given a needle, get to do your own business, and then you get to dispose of the needle. That's the other thing. The idea is that you won't have to walk down the streets of Seattle having your kid pick up a used needle as one of my friend's kids did. And so that is another one of the supposed reasons why you should support this. Okay. The Seattle Times reports that, quote, they say the sites would help, they say the sites would keep drug users alive long enough to seek treatment and give people on the margins of society means to access help. I feel like that's a sort of a pie in the sky dream. That's not actually going to happen. With all due respect, the vast majority of the people that we're talking about here who are addicts, they're not just one extra day away from getting help. They're one day away from saying, hey, I need it so badly that they won't go to the inside spot. They'll use on their own, and then they'll overdose and die. These people are one day away constantly from ending their own life through their own drug addiction. They don't seek out treatment because heroin is a different kind of drug. It's not that you're just going to hit rock bottom on heroin and then say, oh, I better turn my life around. That's generally not how this drug works. And a big reason behind it is because it literally changes the physical structure of the brain. It changes the physiology of the brain. It ruins people's lives. You have a total fallout with family. A lot of times you are completely separated from your family as a direct result of this. So from the people who care enough about you to try to get you help, you are completely disconnected from them. Now, I don't have to say it. We can hear from actual addicts who are saying this. And so I'll let an addict who was talking with NBC Nightly News. She's a former figure skater. And this is what she told them.
You lose yourself. The drugs isolate you from your family. They isolate you from your friends.
They isolate you from your family and your friends. And when you are addicted to a drug like heroin, whose addiction is so severe that you desperately need other people to get you help, to get you on that right path, it seems like there's no way that you're ever going to get help. But here's the thing. You know, what was it? They say the sites would keep drug users alive long enough to seek treatment and give people on the margins of society means to access help. Oh, yeah.
When she scores, she comes through these doors, as she's done over 8,000 times.
8,000 times. 8,000 times. That's insane.
I don't even really know how you
do you know how, I mean,
count.
Try and do the math, what that means in a year. I mean, 8,000 times. That is a lot of times that we're going to pretend that she's just one day away from turning around and saying, man, I really could use that treatment right now. Oh, good news. Insight in these legal sites supposedly have like a pamphlet that you can get. That'll tell you why heroin addiction is bad. And maybe you'll read the pamphlet and all of a sudden you'll say, oh, I want some help. Or you'll have some nurse there who will say, hey, we've got some resources for you. I'm sure they'll give that consideration as they're jonesing for their next fix. I'm sure that they're going to be in the right state of mind. Now, Seattle is not the only city that's considering this. The city of Ithaca, New York is considering it. Mayor Svante Myrick was also on NBC Nightly News saying this.
What we're proposing is an entirely new approach to the war on drugs, one that's based in public health instead of criminal justice. Nobody has to tell me that drugs are bad. You know, my father was an addict. It ruined his health. It ruined his life. And it nearly broke our family.
And so your reaction is to give people more access to do the drug that ruined your father's life. Now, if I were to be interviewed on NBC Nightly News, I would probably say something like this.
The problem I have is that it might normalize the behavior. It's almost like this coddling behavior where we want to say it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. It's not okay. You're killing yourself.
You're literally killing yourself, and we seem to be okay with it because we're pushing this idea that, hey, we can't judge people who are doing drugs. We don't want to judge them. That would be mean. We should be judging them. We should absolutely be judging people who are addicted to heroin. Not as bad people, but as victims. That's what they are. They are victims of a disgusting and game-changing, life-ending addiction to heroin. And yet we have a lot of enablers out there. We have a lot of people who want to normalize this behavior. At the same time, they want to enable these addicts to continue to go down this path. One of them is a guy by the name of Shiloh Murphy. He's local. He runs the People's Harm Reduction Alliance. They have a needle exchange program in the university district. He's one of the groups that's trying to push for this spot for quote-unquote safe heroin injection sites. By the way, there's no such thing as a safe heroin injection. When you put heroin into your body, it is inevitably and inherently dangerous. He says to the Seattle Times, this isn't a matter of if, this is a matter of when. We need to move ahead as fast as we can because this is a crisis, because people are dying. So he's saying people are dying, so let's give them the drug that's literally killing them. And by the way, just so you know who this guy is, he was on this show with Todd Herman filling in last year. Listen to this exchange.
We're sitting here together, let's say you and I, and there's a 17-year-old girl with us. And she says, Shiloh, I'm thinking about smoking meth.
I would ask her why she...
I want to get high, really high.
Then if that is what you're after, then it's probably you're on your way to doing that anyway. And so
what would you advise her?
I would advise her to probably use a pipe before using an injection.
Oh, but just before, I mean, at some point, if you want to go down the injections, I want you to come over to my place and I'll give you this this free, cheap, or whatever it is, clean needle for you to continue. What a great guy. What an awesome guy who I'm sure thinks he's doing some fantastic work. The difference between someone like him and me is if you tell me that a 17-year-old girl seems destined to do meth, my question is, well, can we maybe prevent that by going at the root cause? Like, why is she doing that? What is it about her that is feeling that makes her feel like she has to do that? And instead of giving people needles and spoons and maybe a back rub as they're injecting themselves with a deadly, deadly, deadly drug, shocking idea. How about treatment? I mean, if we're talking about addicts, why don't we give them treatment? Why don't we say the compassionate thing to do is not to simply stop the overdoses by allowing them to do the drug in front of you, but stop the overdoses by making it so that they're not addicted to the drug that causes the overdose. I know that that is just shocking way of life, a way of thinking. I understand that. It's whoa. But if something's bad for you and it's leading to your death, why don't we stop doing it? Well, it's hard, Jason. Yeah, it's totally hard. It's totally hard. But all you're doing is postponing the inevitable for these people. These people are going to die. They may not die from an overdose, but they'll die from the impacts of taking heroin 8,000 times in a short amount of time. But Jason, there's always hope. It's possible.
There's still that hope that you can get better, and I still have hope.
Oh, she still has hope. And I listen to something like that, and I feel so bad. She may have hope, but she is a lost cause until someone gets in there and actually gets her treatment. Because every single day that you give her access to a room in which she is able to, without any judgment whatsoever, without any pressure whatsoever, to insert drugs into the vein, she's never going to have any help. But we have this PC nonsense. You got to just normalize it. You don't want them to feel like you've microaggressed them. It's disturbing. And, you know, it's disgusting. And you're not, I'm sorry, I'm not supposed to say that. Someone sent me a link to a tweet from I think she still works at The Stranger. Does she still work? Yeah, she's a reporter at The Stranger. She sent a tweet. Oh, good. The only Seattle person interviewed in this piece about safe injection sites is Jason Rantz. Oh, my God. They're talking to someone that I don't like because he says things that I disagree with. We have to stop people from talking to people who hold opinions that are never from mine. Oh, my gosh. How are we going to stop it? We can only understand we're doing it because we care. We're doing it because we're so we have compassion for all these heroin addicts. So here, I'm going to insert the needle for you because it's so hard for them to do it. They view compassion literally as giving them space to do the drugs. I view compassion as giving them the space to get treatment, to getting them that treatment for free, we spend any money on a safe injection site. And look, in Seattle, this is going to happen. The Seattle City Council seems apt to take this. The mayor seems more on the side of doing this than not. This is going to happen, and it is such a shame because these people are more interested in talking about how progressive they are on their drug policies than actually treating these people. And these people are never going to be treated. Turns out when you're addicted to something and they're giving you that ability to feed that addiction, they don't all of a sudden say, I'd like some help. Why would they like some help? You've just made it so easy for them to commit the drug use, right? You can weigh in now because you had a look on your face, Jacob.
Oh, no. I don't know how happy Heidi Groover would be with that representation.
Well, that, to be fair, is my representation of everybody.
Okay.
But, I mean, that is probably how she sounds. Everyone who complains in my head sounds like that.
Oh,
very whiny.
So, oh my God, they're talking to someone like Jason. He votes Republican. He doesn't.
Big babies.
I regret bringing it up again.
I know. Why'd you bring it up again? By the way, just real quick, because you saw the piece, my hair was fantastic.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
What do you mean pretty good? It was fantastic. I wore a suit, had a little tie on from Top Man, had a strong suit blazer on, had some Zara pants on.
I mean, they couldn't see the pants.
Yeah, but the photo, you could have saw the pants. If you want to watch the video, that's all I got. I got some good B-roll on the thing.
Oh, yeah, they staged a show on the weekend.
Yeah, I just came in. We just turned everything down, and I pretended I was doing the radio show for the B-roll. Go check it out. We posted it on the Facebook page, facebook.com/JasonRantShow. Welcome back to the Jason Rant Show. If only some of you could have heard that break. So I was doing the whining voice to Jacob, who hasn't really experienced it. I think I did it the majority of the break.
Oh, I'm so upset because people are there who disagree with what I say and they shouldn't be allowed to talk. Oh.
It was the worst.
Oh, it's how they all talk. Let's quickly do this. Speaking of whiners, we've got another... Why? Carol 7 reports the current arena deal in Seattle calls for Seattle and King County to contribute up to $200 million in bond money to help pay for a Sonics arena in the Soto neighborhood next to Safeco Field. And the money becomes available only if billionaire Chris Hansen brings back the Sonics to Seattle. But of course, now people are standing in the way again. More. I thought that this was done, but attorney Cleveland Stockmeyer, whose name already indicates that he's not going to be a pain at all, he says he opposes the current arena deal.
I oppose subsidies for billionaires.
Okay. Oh, my gosh. So he's working on a new, stronger version of Initiative 91, which is the 2006 law that prohibits taxpayer subsidies for sports arenas. Can we stop this? Like, can we just give up? This is like the pot story. You've lost. Okay, the majority of people want this arena there. I understand that you, because I guess some ideological perspective of not wanting to help out billionaires, because all of a sudden, this guy should put up the $500 million required, minimum, to bring the stadium here, to bring a team here. The state completely benefits completely more than he does. In the long term, the state and the city will benefit way more than Chris Hansen will. And the city should just nothing. Just do your thing, and we're not going to get involved. I love this idea. Look, Chris Hansen putting up in the group of people, the investors who are putting up this money, and I believe it was something like $500 million. So he would be putting up $300 million. This stadium brings in hundreds of millions of dollars into the city of Seattle and the state of Washington. Over its long term, assuming this were to happen, the Sonics were here and it, you know, was a moderately successful franchise. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars coming into the economy. Thousands of jobs. And the city can't get involved at all? Just as a gesture of goodwill to say, look, we want to be partners with this. We want to be partners with you. We want to show our commitment to the team. We want to have some buy-in. It's just, I'm so done. And this stupid, stupid, stupid argument that because the actual stadium would take up a portion of Occidental Avenue, which is, you know, the street south of Safeco Field, people say, oh, this is going to impact all of the union workers who, you know, dry, all the longshoremen, all the railroad people. This is just going to hurt. Oh, my God.
We welcome the return to NBA basketball to Seattle. But we need a new deal in a new location.
Oh, because it's going to cause all this traffic. Because there's not enough traffic in SoDo that they're dealing with. Like, they're not currently dealing. Here's the thing. Occidental Avenue, that street, regardless of how you feel about this decision to move a stadium there, which, by the way, I'm actually against, but we'll get that in a second. The only people who drive on Occidental Avenue are people trying to find parking. Okay, let's stop pretending that this is like this major street that all these trucks go down. Like, yeah, trucks use it, but it's also, they're already competing with a bunch of people. You just move over one. I'm not as familiar as I am with this, with the basketball, than I am with the soccer. Are there basketball games like in the middle of the day? Is there like a 1 p.m. tip-off?
Only on a weekend.
Oh, okay. So this isn't going to interfere at all, okay? Except during the period that you're actually building the thing. Okay.
There's a Krispy Kreme down that road that it might be harder to get to.
The people are running to SoDo for the Krispy Kreme.
Yeah.
Just a bunch of babies. And by the way, I don't even think that we should put the thing there. I don't think we need another stadium in SoTo. I wanted to go to Tukwila or Renton. Go to the east side.
I wanted to go to the Northgate Mall.
Do it the Northgate Mall. I'm happy to get it out of Seattle. Seattle doesn't need to get everything, okay? We got enough. I like to spread the wealth. But complainers like this, I just, you know, whatever. Now bring it to SoTo. I'm going to start the pro-SoTo movement. It's the Jason Rand Show. We've been pro-SoTo since 2012.